Today we have with us Kristen Gustafson, which is, she is going to talk about the community care piece of this JPOW initiative that we've been looking at. And she's pretty qualified to do that, not only as a PhD in social work and someone who's worked extensively in the Bay Area on some of the issues we'll be talking about, but also as a longtime member of First Press Berkeley and now the new executive director of Berkeley Christian Counselors. So knows the issues well, but also knows our congregation and community well. So we're so thrilled that Kristen could join us this morning. And if you wouldn't mind bowing your heads with me, I'd love to just open us up in prayer. God, thank you so much for the chance to be here this morning together and to look at these difficult issues, but to also look at how you are calling us as a community and a congregation to reach out to those around us, both within our own congregation and the community that's right outside our doors. I pray that you would open our hearts this morning to the things that you are wanting us to hear, and that you would continue to work in us as we listen and hear these things today. Be with Kristen as she speaks, and in your name we pray these things. Amen.
Amen. Thanks, Bridget. Well, good morning. Thank you for the introduction, Bridget. Again, my name is Kristen, and I'm the executive director over at Berkeley Christian Counselors, which is just that brown shingle building right over there. We occupy almost all of the third floor in that building, and we deal with issues of trauma and women all the time. A lot of what we're doing is trauma-informed counseling. We have quite a few folks who've had some kind of traumatic experience, often because of abuse or issues of violence in their community or in their homes. And it's also an issue that we wrestle with at the church, which I'll talk about a little bit when I talk about the First Press response. Today I'm going to focus primarily on issues of abuse and violence. There are lots of other issues that we can and should include in this plank of community care. Workplace harassment of women, issues that are dealing specifically with children. We do talk a little bit about children in the presentation today, but there's a lot more going on in our community. So this is really a broad strokes effort to tackle a bit of this community care piece. So we'll spend a bit of time talking about what does this really mean? What are the stats? What are some of the evidence that this is an issue? So a little bit on one slide on history, for all you history people out there. I'm married to somebody who really likes history, so I tend to put that stuff in there, knowing that there are people that really enjoy hearing that. Some of what is that? What are we actually talking about that we should be looking for as members of the community and the church? What are some of the warning signs that should stand out to us? And then we'll talk a little bit about the fact that First Press actually does deal with this. We do have a pastoral response. We do have policies in place. We won't spend a lot of time on that, but it should be good for you to just know that we have that and a little bit of what that involves. I also have a short video in here that talks a little bit from a survivor's experience of what that sort of cycle of violence was like, and even how she initially didn't consider herself to be somebody who was abused and has sort of come around on that definition. And I think her misconceptions are some of our common misconceptions too, so that can help clarify things as well. We'll talk a little bit about community resources. It should be clear that one thing you won't be getting is like a community resources packet of sort of referrals and shelters and things like that, in part because BCC holds that role at the church. So anytime anyone needs a referral, we hold referrals for all kinds of social services across the Bay Area. And they're constantly changing. So the minute I provide you with something in print is the minute it changes. Funding sources for those things are also changing and are affected. So part of our job is keeping up on all of that. But anytime somebody needs a referral, you can call Berkeley Christian Counselors or one of the pastors here at the church who will liaise with us, and we can provide that. But we will talk a little bit about community resources. And then we'll get down into a few more specifics about what you might be able to do specifically. But I am open to adding something to that agenda if anybody has something that they feel like is burning within and wants to really make sure I try and address. I can certainly try and incorporate that. Otherwise, we will press on. Okay, great. All right. So in terms of the statistics, they aren't pretty. And for those of you who picked up a copy of the presentation, you'll have these. Some people really like having the statistics. There's one caveat to these, which I'll talk about in a minute, but we'll kind of talk national statistics and then state statistics, sort of set a context, really, for what we're talking about today. So these are Department of Justice statistics, Bureau of Justice statistics, or peer-reviewed research articles on domestic violence. You'll hear those terms used interchangeably: domestic violence, partner abuse, intimate partner violence. So sometimes you hear IPV, DV, when you're in that field, and all of those terms are used really interchangeably. The move does seem to be is more toward partner abuse, one, because we are seeing more research being done and therefore more confirmation that abuse is taking place in same-sex relationships, so not spousal abuse necessarily, or just some of those terms get confused. So there is sort of a movement in the field to begin talking about partner abuse, but you will see all of those terms used interchangeably. Just here are some statistics. Nationwide, about 1 in 4 women are beaten or raped by a partner during adulthood. So that's sort of a lifetime prevalence statistic from the Department of Justice. 1 in 6 women and 1 in 33 men have experienced an attempted or completed rape. Within the military, this is even higher. It's estimated to be in 1 in 6 men in the military. And we don't have a lot of studies on prison. As you can imagine, that is an extremely vulnerable population, so it's difficult to get studies approved for studies in prison in the first place, but also prisoners are reluctant to divulge that information. There have been a couple studies that do indicate that the sort of conception out in the community that sexual violence is rampant in prison is confirmed, but we don't really have data to support what the actual prevalence rates are. But that's a really good question. In college, there's a survey of college students where 27.5% of the women surveyed suffered a rape or attempted rape at least once since the age of 14. Homicide rates in the United States in general are stagnant or going down depending on what state you're in. The homicide rates for intimate partner-related violence, however, seem to be going up. We used to be about 1 in 4, and now we're about 1 in 3 of, let's see, it's about 2/3 of women who are killed by a firearm-related incident are killed by a partner, an abusive partner. So 3 women are killed by a current or former partner every day in America. And that 22% of women and 7.4% of men report being physically assaulted by a current or former partner in their lifetime. Yes.
So are these increasing or decreasing?
I mean, the horrifying statistics. So the homicide rates do seem to be one of those statistics that is increasing. And it's interesting because it's unclear as to what the increase is about. Are we getting better at capturing the reasons or the relationships for involved parties? You know, it's taken some linking in the past for researchers to do that because it didn't necessarily indicate in the criminal record or incident report that it was an intimate partner. So one, we're doing better at collecting that information. So incidence rates seem to be going up, but it could be in part because it's actually an increasing problem, and it could also be in part because we're doing better at capturing the information. So it's hard for me to say, but the experts in that particular study of homicide-related incidents seem to indicate that it's too much growth to just be captured by we're getting better at collecting the data. So, but you sort of have to take that a little bit with a grain of salt because I'm not exactly sure how to report that. Okay, again, some more statistics. 2.3 million people a year are raped or physically assaulted by a current or former boyfriend, spouse, girlfriend, partner, etc. Women who are assaulted averaged almost 7 physical assaults per year by that same partner. We are better at collecting information on women, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but a lot of the surveys that we have are literally like the survey on women in domestic violence. So, you know, that survey is only surveying women. So some of our data on men is just simply missing. But we do know that it's not good. 37% of women seeking injury-related hospital ER treatment are there because of intimate partner-inflicted injuries. And then women are 6 times more likely than men to experience violence at the hands of a partner, to be most impacted by that kind of treatment. It does not get better for California. According to the California Women's Health Survey, we have 40% of women experiencing physical or intimate partner violence in their lifetimes. So again, this is lifetime prevalence. This is not like what's happening in a year, but still a staggering statistic. We have a California student survey similar to that National College Student Survey. This one is looking at dating violence, and not just college students, but younger students as well, and we're seeing this in 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th grades, where 5.2% of 9th graders and 8.2% of 11th graders. And actually, if you just look at folks who are in an actual intimate relationship or have a boyfriend, girlfriend, those statistics go up. Because you can imagine there's lots of 9th graders that aren't dating or don't have exposure to that kind of dating violence. But among those that do, rates are as high as almost 9% and almost 13% in 9th and 11th graders. So this is something that we're seeing at earlier and earlier ages. Hi, Ian. I don't think you really get to do a lot of sneaking, but welcome. Again, a few more statistics. So in 2007, and this is the most recent year for which data has been compiled in California, 110 women were killed by their partners, which accounts for about 5% of all California homicides. So of all homicides, not just intimate partner or being killed by someone known to you, but of all homicides, that's about 5% of them. Law enforcement, so that's sheriff, police, all that, received virtually 175,000 domestic violence calls, 40% of which involved some kind of weapon, primarily handguns. And as of April 2008, we had almost 250,000 domestic violence-related protective orders in California. So for those of you who know the population of California, that's virtually one for every 150 people here in the state. So if you think about it in terms of church membership or folks in the community, in Berkeley, in the Bay Area, every one of 150 people has some kind of protective order in place. And the interesting thing is, data also indicates that for folks, women specifically, who actually apply for protective orders and qualify for them based on the standards set forth in the state requirements, only about half of them get them. So if we have, for lots of reasons that you can imagine, for example, sometimes judges are hesitant to put a protective order in place if it means limiting access for someone to their children. So sometimes protective orders, even though folks qualify for them, they don't get enacted. But we have 250,000 of them in the state. Okay. All right. So let me talk about the caveat. This is a big caveat. It just is a brand new, huge, multi-university, multi-researcher study that came out actually just this last month. And that's PASC, which is the Partner of Youth State of Knowledge Project. I think it's 20 universities and 42 researchers across 30 areas of domestic violence research. So some of them are on risk, some of them are on protective orders, some of the studies are looking. And basically what they did was all of these researchers got together and in their specialty area started conducting systematic literature reviews on what's the state of knowledge out there, what do we actually know, and made recommendations for the future study and of science. And their biggest conclusion was that it's actually a bit of a misconception to continue to call domestic violence a women's issue. They did, however, confirm that women are the most impacted by domestic violence. So in terms of requiring the most intervention, being the most affected, whether that be an injury, legal situations, financial, et cetera, women are the most affected. But in terms of perpetration, rates of perpetration, men and women seem to perpetrate at fairly similar levels and for the same reasons and based on the same risk factors. When women perpetrate, however, it seems to result in much less of an impact than it does when men perpetrate. Does that make sense? So those are basically their biggest conclusions. Yeah.
Can you help me parse that sentence? Does that mean that men and women perpetrate physical violence and men and women perpetrate non-physical forms of abuse at similar rates, or does that mean combined men and women, combined physical?
Whether you're looking at physical or non-physical, men and women perpetrate at similar rates, according to the study that literally just came out this last month. So this is sort of changing the research community and the policy community and the intervention community. In part, as you can imagine, the idea of domestic violence shelters. So we can talk about this when we talk about what this means for the community. But take this to a community level, and you're trying to provide intervention. Can you provide intervention at one shelter where you're co-locating all kinds of perpetrators? So services right now tend to be primarily for women because they're the most and most significantly affected. But we're beginning to question that. Yes?
That third point is hard to understand because it is well known that men are outwardly violent towards each other, not alone women. We haven't even addressed male violence to each other and how that's not reported. But you know what we're saying? One of the male prejudice would be is that women are more masters of passive aggressive violence than women are quite sophisticated enough.
Exactly.
And implement. I mean, so that's why we act out violence, is because we're not as much aware of emotional tools.
So in the advocacy community, and I think in the research community some as well, this new presentation of findings has been hotly discussed. You know, women have much less access to firearms. Women who do engage in physical violence tend to not use weapons to the same degree that men do, or they use different weapons. So we really are talking about apples and oranges. At the same time, even the concept of mutual abuse, a lot of the women's advocacy groups have been saying, so in order for that not to be caught on a research survey, we're just supposed to curl up into a ball and not respond. Because some of that research is catching those kinds of, with questions like, did you hit back, did you fight back? That then begins to fall into the category of, from a research perspective, of mutual abuse. Rather than, even in a legal community, that's going to be considered self-defense. So some of how we study this issue either doesn't reflect how we capture it legally and is shifting, either because we've ignored men for the predominant history of our research study of domestic abuse, or because we just don't quite know how to characterize things well in terms of what's happening in that violent family relationship.
Right.
So anyway, I present this caveat, one, because it's the new emerging research in the field, so it's the most up-to-date that we have. And two, because it's a different lens through which we should view, one, some of these statistics in recognizing that while still predominantly a women's issue, because women, and this research confirms it, are the ones most impacted, there is another element of it that either has been ignored in the research and policy and services that kind of goes into this mix, and you don't see that in a lot of... So all the statistics that we talked about on the first few slides don't reflect any of this. If you're going to have the survey for women in violence, they're going to give you some really great statistics on what's happening with women in violence, but men will be virtually ignored in that. Yes? You know, I don't know. That's a really good question. In terms of homicide rates, we do know that that's pretty low, men compared to women. But in terms of how that translates into protective orders, I'm not sure. A colleague of mine who's the director of the Rainbow Center out in Contra Costa County seen a much better catchment of this in same-sex couples. And it does seem to be that in male-male relationships, intimate relationships, that the rate's about 15%. And for women-women relationships, it's right around 10, 11. So I don't know if that shapes anything, but yeah.
You mentioned the early detection in eighth grade, and also seeing that his latest report shows it's not really a gender issue, it's a culture issue.
Right. Yeah. So the question was, in terms of the early dating violence that we're seeing, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th grade, are there any positive trends that we see emerging with regard to healthy relationships for people relating to one another? Did I catch that right?
That's a good chunk.
I don't know. For the recording is the answer. I think that's a great question, and it's one that's continues to be debated, in part because sort of where the responsibility lies for forming citizens that can live respectfully with one another is continued to be hotly debated. So there are faith communities that have responded with sort of healthy dating, sort of early dating intervention. There have been some efforts at the school level. In some, starting with that kind of rolled out of internet safety campaigns, where a lot of this, there just can be a lot of fuzziness in terms of what is a healthy relationship and how does it start. And because we're seeing a lot more teen dating relationships start in that realm, sort of how to be healthy and safe, there have been some interventions in that regard. But I think that's a really good question. Yes.
Follow-up, I think there's probably pretty good evidence that a lot of these problems happen before school, or preschool. And I thought what I'd be hoping to hear is that there's something about, like many denominations have preparatory classes for couples.
Right. Which we also have here. So the question was, or follow-up comment was really, we do have gotten better at preparing people for marriage in terms of marital preparation courses, how well do you know each other, how compatible are you, all of these different kinds of things, the inventories that go along with that. Has there been any effort to sort of do something similar at a teen dating level? I have not seen any well-implemented curriculum. There have been, I would just say, you know, anecdotal evidence that that's happening a bit more. But I can't respond on a sort of larger scale level. I think that's a great question, and you should bring it back in again at the end when we start talking about what can we do as a community. We do hear that from the college ministry here, that that's an issue at the college level. I haven't necessarily heard that from our youth ministers here, but I'm not ruling it out. At the counseling center, we tend to see trauma-related issues to violence and abuse. And the reason they end up coming to us is because they've developed some kind of other issues that go along with that. So, for example, a 15-year-old client that we're seeing doesn't just happen to have an eating disorder. Those disorders tend to develop out of trauma or as a reaction or coping to significant trauma. So while we're also dealing with the issues of the eating disorder, we're also trying to address what the earlier trauma was related to abuse, violence, dating, etc. So sometimes there are interventions happening, but they don't necessarily get sort of caught under the rubric, I would say, of family violence, even though the trauma is based in that area. But we're treating something that whose root cause really is that kind of trauma. So when I talk about trauma-informed care, a lot of that grows from the knowledge that people don't just develop these issues. They really grow out of the trauma they've experienced. Yes. Right. So we, you know, that's an interesting comment, and actually is an interesting comment with a lot of abuse research. How does that sort of mandatory element of treatment work? The short answer is that it works really poorly. Mandatory anger management, mandatory perpetrator treatment tends to have fairly bad outcomes in terms of reducing incidents and reducing abuse to victims. And that's part of the sort of dance we do with what we really offer as voluntary treatment or voluntary counseling and what might be needed to be recommended, which is periodic checkups. We all need that. But the reality is that it's pretty hard to enforce, but it's certainly something, you know, it's interesting. Children's Ministries here is one of the very wonderful ministries we have. And on the anniversary of both of my kids' baptisms, we get a card in the mail reminding us of that date, which is so nice, and sort of recognizing that reconfirmation of the fact that we believe in Jesus Christ and are wanting that same relationship for our children, and that's why we took that step. But we don't get anything like that on our anniversary, one, because we weren't married here, but two, just because... You know, but do we have, you know, that's when we go out to dinner and that's when we visit Chez Panisse, right? But it's not necessarily like, do we do that checkup on our, you know, and we have a fairly healthy relationship. And that's not, you know, imagine how much more difficult that bar would be where there's any kind of conflict. Okay. Yes. And we do offer that. Right. We actually don't serve any mandatory clients here at our counseling center. So those would be needing to go through like a court-approved program, and there are some. We have them in Berkeley, Walnut Creek, San Rafael, and all over, court-mandated and approved court-ordered treatment for anger management, for like batterers groups, et cetera. I hope so.
It's late in the game either way.
Right. We tend to not see a lot of perpetrators in our clinic. I'm not sure why that is, unless that it's just that they tend to go through the mandated programs rather than the voluntary. Occasionally we see folks for addiction and find out through the course of their treatment that they're perpetrators in one way or another. But they don't report to us, in general, the outcomes of their, the only way we would know is if they're self-reporting reduction in their violent or abusive behavior. So, one, I guess I would say it's not clientele we see a lot of, and two, it's very difficult data to track, which is why it ends up getting tracked through formal batterer programs. Does that make sense? All right, well, these are great questions. Continue to interrupt as we go along, but I am going to move us along. Here's my one history slide. And it goes back to the 19th century, so this is good history, right? And, you know, you can't really talk about this unless you bring in Freud. So Charcot is really Freud's predecessor, and he, this was back in the day of sort of the medical theater. And he was the first guy to really study hysteria, which was sort of the women's issue of the time. And basically, women who had been in the asylum and were labeled as hysterics became relatively famous, actually, actresses in his medical theater. And that was really the first, you know, actors would come, all the fashionable people of Paris would attend these medical theaters where the hysterics would sort of be put on display. It was the first real study of of the psychopathology relating to abuse and trauma. And that was really Charcot's conclusion, which Freud took even further when he wrote The Etiology of Hysteria in the late 1800s. Basically was these kinds of psychopathologies, these behaviors that we're seeing among women are because of abuse and trauma. In particular, what they noticed was sexual abuse, sexual violence, that resulted in significant impairment in daily functioning, or what they termed psychopathology, and what really was the root of the growth of psychoanalysis out of Freud's movement. The interesting thing was that Freud's conclusion was that, if all the female patients I'm seeing are having this sort of root cause, this sort of root history, then this problem is rampant. And that's impossible. It just can't be that. It cannot be that one in four of the women I see when I'm walking down the street have had the experience of the women I'm seeing in my research and practice. It just can't be. So despite the evidence to the contrary, his conclusion, which really affected, as you can imagine, the history of how we saw the problem for virtually a century, was really driven by his categorical denial that conclusion could possibly be correct. It must be incorrect. And so that was part of how we got to some of his more interesting theories about sort of penis envy. Is it okay to say penis at church? I can't believe I just said penis at church. Now I've said it three times. Yeah. But sort of the idea that these women that he really was the, he and Charcot and Jeannette were really the sort of the first guys to really truly take the time to not just observe. Charcot was more the clinical observer, but then take it a step further and really listen. What are the stories? What's going on? And those documented stories are really the first formal documentations that we have of this kind of abuse taking place in the lives of women, and that it was rampant. But the unfortunate conclusion was that it just couldn't be so. So that really derailed, in some ways, our study and understanding of violence in the family, violence in relationships, and in particular early violence, because a lot of what Freud observed was not just domestic partner violence, which did happen, but also really early childhood violence that continued to carry on, which we hear about now. We kind of assume, you know, well, this is something we've always known, you know, the cycle of violence in the family, and that someone who's grown up in a family that's had this cycle of violence is more likely to join or be a part of a family where that cycle of violence is repeated. Before the 1890s, that wasn't something we knew. And then we really quickly sort of veered away from that realm of study. And some of that was the political environment, as you can imagine. It wasn't just Freud's recantation. He recanted that within a political environment that was like, no, we are not going to give women this kind of voice in the world. We're just not. And so some of the letters that have been published from major politicians to Freud are kind of fascinating. But you can read his Etiology of Hysteria. It's still in print. And some of those stories where you can are really interesting, where you see that he really was truly listening to his female patients. But it was post publication of that those case studies, really, that we saw a turn. And some of that turn is more what we might be familiar with in the language of family violence. That's a family issue. That's a private family matter. I'm not going to get involved in matters of family. That was sort of the predominant law enforcement perspective, really, until about two decades ago. And then we began to see a shift, in part because of the feminist movement, and also in part because of research being done in this area and collected with regard to family violence and violence against women in intimate relationships. We're still having some, you know, there's obviously still room for growth, but that just gives you a little bit of the sort of brief history up until that point. Any questions about, okay. All right, I did want to talk a little bit about consequences for children, even though it's not something we're focusing on primarily today. It is a huge issue and continues to contribute to that family cycle of violence that we do hear about and we'll talk about today. About half of female IPV victims or intimate partner violence victims live in households with children under the age of 12. And we also know through research that children who've been exposed to violence generally suffer symptoms of what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, but you know, that can include bedwetting, nightmares, severe anxiety, depression, headaches, other physical or somatic symptoms can be. So that tends to be what we see either in the medical community or in a counseling center. Can you help my kid? They're wetting the bed. So when I talk about the fact that we're trauma therapists, that's what I'm talking about. Yes, we want to treat the symptom or the issue, but the symptom isn't really the problem. It's the root trauma that's the issue. And we see that in children as well. And we also know that exposure to violence predicts children's current and future violent behavior. So it's not something to ignore. And just so that we talk about a little bit more clearly, when I mention that cycle of violence, I don't necessarily assume that you know what I'm talking about. But we're really talking about some kind of abuse and sort of really leading into this cycle where both the perpetrator and the victim are then, the reaction is guilt. They feel bad about what they did. They feel bad about the behavior. And then the next step is sort of excuses making. Well, if you'd bought cream of wheat instead of oatmeal, I wouldn't have had to XYZ. Literally, sometimes it's that kind of an excuse, not I was having a really bad day or whatever. And often those excuses result in some kind of blaming. I did this, but it's really your fault. It's really, so when you hear that phrase, blaming the victim, that comes from this model of the family cycle of violence. And then there's this sort of phase of normal behavior where everything's just forget that happened. We're not going to talk about it. Let's just ignore it. And we get back into a routine. And some people also refer to this as like the honeymoon phase, where it's this, oh, things are great, or he, you know, he felt really bad and he brought me flowers, or those kinds of behaviors happen in this kind of period of the cycle. And then when we talk about fantasy and planning, we're really talking about fantasy and planning on the part of the perpetrator or the abuser, where they really begin thinking about how am I going to exercise this kind of control and abuse again, and what does that really look like? It is a bit of a myth that abuse is spontaneous or something that happens, and I just went into this rage and couldn't control it. Most abuse happens to be planned. And you can kind of carry that logic out a little bit by thinking about, really, the abuse tends to happen in very specific realms and relationships, and control is possible and exhibited in other relationships. So, for example, the abuse is happening at home, but extreme control is being exercised at work. So the idea that, you know, I just can't control myself is a misconception, because most abusers can and do exhibit quite a bit of control, depending on where they are and what relationship they're talking about. And then this cycle continues with what we refer to as the setup. And it doesn't have to be anything super orchestrated. It's not sort of like an A-team kind of move, but really a setup of, you know, why don't you just go ahead and take the car? Go ahead, take the car, go to the grocery store. It's fine, I trust you. Comes home with groceries, and then we get back to a cycle of abuse. Why did it take you so long? I think it should have taken 20 minutes to go to the grocery store, and you were gone 45. You must be having an affair with the clerk or the whatever, or you didn't go to the grocery store. You went and saw XYZ. And so there's been this setup where the person's like, wow, you're really going to let me take the car? Are you serious? Okay. And then the cycle starts all over again. So that just would be an example of how that might play out. Any questions about that? Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I'll pass out my cards and BCC brochures for everyone. And anybody that has questions, you can call me or email me anytime. So the comment for the recording, Bridget, I'm trying to be diligent, was just that that wasn't something that had been is common knowledge in terms of what the cycle of violence is. Yes. Yeah. Our state of knowledge is. And more than that, it shows me how difficult the problem is must be studied. And tying it into this slide, I can imagine that this data is very difficult to garner because it requires someone to come forward who themselves may feel that they're the reason, that they're not the victim of violence, but they're the reason that they're the victim. When you see Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But similar requirement is not, there is not that requirement for violence against men or violence against men. It takes a huge step for a victim to come forward and report that, you know, my wife has been beating me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, one thing that could be done is it really should be a requirement that nurses and doctors report evidence of contact.
So let me just sum up for the recording really quickly, and then I'll respond. So the comment really was about the just really the state of knowledge and how the PASC study really does shine a light on how poor our state of knowledge is and has been until now. And two, really, that you showcase a couple of things. One is the mandated reporting laws that we have in the state, that we're required to report child and elder abuse. And as a therapist, I am too, pastors, there are lots of people that fall into that category of being a mandated reporter. We are not mandated reporters for domestic violence. There is an exception, and that is if you're an ER doctor. If you're an ER doctor or nurse, you see someone in the emergency room, the law is very specific, then you are required to report that. But most people are going to present to their primary care physician or in a primary care clinic, and therefore you would actually be held liable rather than be considered being a helping if you report that kind of abuse. Part of that is because of how we consider or who we consider vulnerable populations. We consider elders to be vulnerable populations, and we can hotly debate that, because why all of a sudden at 64 are you invulnerable and at 65 you are vulnerable, but that's a whole nother lecture. And it's a little bit easier to understand why we consider children to be vulnerable populations. And so those mandated reporting laws are in place to protect our vulnerable populations. We don't consider to be women categorically to be a vulnerable population, which is part of why the laws are the way they are. But it makes the data very difficult to catch. So when you saw some of that early data on California emergency rooms, the only reason we have that is because the California mandated reporting law on doctors in emergency rooms. That's why we're able to capture that data. Right.
And I think as more and more women become doctors and that are representing the professional, hopefully that will be standard that will be
increased. Yeah. So let me just capture that really quickly. So the comment was about, you know, it would be fairly easy, fairly seamless for physicians to be able to, you know, ask about the things they usually ask about, smoking, alcohol, and also ask about abuse and domestic violence. It could be an added best practice that wouldn't be too hard. And with more women physicians coming online, we might see that. So I just wanted to take that comment into account. Thank you. Okay. So just did want to talk a little bit about warning signs. So this is part, you know, the statistics are interesting, the history is a little bit interesting, but in terms of what actually matters for you, what you might observe out in the community, in your neighborhood, in your workplace, among family and friends, this is probably one of the more relevant pieces, is what are actually some of the warning signs. And the biggest one that seems to cross all layers of abuse, whether it be physical, financial, emotional, etc., is the element of fear. When you get into a situation or you're observing, this person seems to be afraid. So we had a client who whose colleague had been killed by a spouse and was coming, obviously, for the counseling needed as a result of being a bystander and part of that relationship. And one of the things that was talked about was how he would call all the time at work, just call all the time. And the business had taken some steps to get, you know, basically an order in place because this man is disrupting business. And there was sort of this paralysis, though, in terms of what else could they have done to help this person. But one of the things that all of the employees observed as characterized by this person was that this worker who ended up being killed was afraid. She was afraid. She was afraid he was going to show up at work and find her talking to a male colleague. She was afraid of what would happen if somebody answered the phone who didn't know how to handle him. She was, so it was clearly affecting the work environment, which was the part that the business was really concerned about. But there were all of these warning signs in terms of that relationship that they didn't have any sort of feeling or understanding that that was really meaning there was significant abuse likely going on in this relationship, which obviously hindsight is 20/20. But that's the biggest one. If you're seeing somebody who genuinely seems afraid of their partner, they tend to go along with everything their partner does. They check in often. So it's one thing to give, you know, a 15-year-old a curfew and wanting to check in and making sure they're home. It's another thing to do that with an adult intimate partner. But that's often what's happening. Receiving frequent harassing phone calls, et cetera, emails, and they talk about their partner. Oh, he's got a little bit of a temper. Usually that's not how I describe my spouse, or people that are in healthy relationships, that's not the first thing that comes out, that they're talking about, well, he's just got a little bit of an anger issue. I know how to deal with it. That's a sign that, okay, if they're talking about that colloquially in conversation, it's a red flag to me that there's something more serious going on there. Yes. So the question is, do we see certain behaviors on the part of the victim? And the answer is yes, especially in a counseling clinic, we see that kind of behavior. I'm going to be really careful with my language because of who's here in the room, but often abusers will call their victims names or blame the violence in some way. So I'm trying to think of what a... It's difficult to differentiate and may not matter. But just getting back real quick to your comment. So for example, can I say prostitute? Is that okay word in this audience? So being called that, but a much worse term for it, okay? Somebody who's getting that message repeatedly may begin to try and dress unattractively, begin to de-feminize or... engage in certain behaviors as a victim because of that sort of name-calling, labeling, that part of the abuse. I mentioned eating disorders before. Sometimes that happens where literally women are trying to lose every curve they might have as a result of that kind of messaging. So it's a whole nother issue that's going on, but it's really a sign in particular of a victim type of behavior. Does that answer your question?
I guess if you're saying that no, these situations are started from the. It sounds like you're saying, if I can interpret what you're saying, this situation starts from being exposed to violence as a child, and the choosing of the partner or the behavior of the partner is not typically causal. If you see behavior that looks like it's related.
So I see the question. So I think some of the question is, are there certain characteristics of victims that either might make them prone to choosing partners like this? Is that the question?
That's another interesting question. More, maybe it's too obtuse.
Okay. So I guess the short answer is that we don't have a particular prototype of a victim. It tends to cross all economic strata, all races and ethnicities, with the exception of being female. That's really the only, and having a past sort of history or exposure to family violence. But other than that, we don't have a lot of set characteristics that tell us this person's going to be more likely to be abused throughout their life than this person. Yes. We're beginning to. Some states are better at it than others. California's pretty good. And so we do have some information on that. And we see some differing patterns depending on the ethnic community. Certain communities might have alcohol be more of an involvement in abuse than other communities. Some communities are prone to use certain kinds of weapons more as far as perpetrators go, but in terms of type or style of abuse, whether it be physical, verbal, et cetera, it seems to cross all ethnicities. Okay. For physical violence in particular, and this is something that you might see a lot in a physician's office, which would be the same thing we would be looking for when we're talking about child abuse, is physical injury, and often at different stages of healing. So it's one thing for somebody to come back from a weekend of, you know, I don't know what causes lots of bruising. For me, it would be a lot of things. But so, you know, mountain bike riding, and you would expect shins. There would be certain areas that you would expect injuries for people that engage in certain kinds of sports. And they might have in those same injuries in different stages of healing. But they're also not going to have a black eye, and they're not going to have bruising on their arm that looks like someone grabbed and twisted or shook them. So some of what we see is bruising in particular areas and at different stages of healing. So that can be a sign for you if you're observing, like, in a coworker situation, something like that. Those are signs of physical violence happening that aren't most likely accidents. There are people that are accident prone. We're not talking about those people. We're talking about something different. They might miss work, school, or social occasions without explanation, and sometimes that's caused by the control and stricture of their partner. So, I'm not going to take you to work today. You're enjoying it too much. So even though there might be financial consequences, this person might lose their job, employment turnover might happen frequently with someone in this situation, it's part of how the abuser is exercising control. So that can be a sign. Or they dress in clothing that's designed to hide their injuries. So they're wearing sunglasses inside, they're wearing long sleeves, and it's, you know, 89 degrees like it is today. Inappropriate things, or they begin dressing differently than they have before. Isolation is also a very common method of abuse. These are not mutually exclusive. You know, physical violence can be happening while psychological abuse is happening, while someone's engaging in isolation. But there would be this kind of restricting. So maybe they always get dropped off at work and picked up by somebody. They're not allowed to make plans with, or you know, you hear this, oh, let me check with my husband, or let me check with my partner, I'll get back to you. Oh, we have plans, that kind of thing. But this idea that they express a desire to participate in social activities, but then aren't able to do that. And there's not a lot of freedom in going out in public, or that's your observation, so that would be a warning sign. In terms of the psychological aspects, the biggest one would be the mental health changes. So seeing somebody become significantly depressed or anxious, some of the fear and issues surrounding that kind of thing, you would notice that being exhibited, or a significant personality change. So here's somebody who was really outgoing, they seemed to really like their job, and now all of a sudden they're afraid all the time. And they're worried about him calling, or they're worried about whatever that might be. That might be something you observe. You could observe that in a friend or a neighbor as well. This person just used to be, and then they got in this relationship, and now they're such a downer to be around. Or you might even observe, like, it seems like she's drinking a lot more than she used to. And especially it seems that's the case when she hangs out with so-and-so. And it might be that that's how she's coping with the controlling and abusive relationship. Okay, so
a lot of times I get comments that this isn't something that's, this cannot possibly be as common. Like, I get those statistics, I heard them all, it's not that I don't believe them, but this isn't people that are like me. So I have this video, it's about 15 minutes. So I think we might at least try and watch part of it. One, because I think it's a great example of a survivor talking who does look like us and talk like us. And it just drives home that point a little bit more. So let's see.
I'm here today to talk about a disturbing question, which has an equally disturbing answer. My topic is the secrets of domestic violence. And the question I'm going to tackle is the one question everyone always asks. Why does she stay? Why would anyone stay with a man who beats her? I'm not a psychiatrist, a social worker, or an expert in domestic violence. I'm just one woman with a story to tell. I was 22. I had just graduated from Harvard College. I'd moved to New York City for my first job as a writer and editor at 17 Magazine. I had my first apartment, my first little green American Express card, and I had a very big secret. My secret was that I had this gun loaded with hollow point bullets pointed at my head by the man who I thought was my soulmate, many, many times. The man who I loved more than anybody on earth held a gun to my head and threatened to kill me more times than I can even remember. I'm here to tell you the story of crazy love, a psychological trap disguised as love, one that millions of women and even a few men fall into every year. It may even be your story. I don't look like a typical domestic violence survivor. I have a BA in English from Harvard College, an MBA in marketing from Wharton Business School. I spent most of my career working for Fortune 500 companies, including Johnson & Johnson, Leo Burnett, and The Washington Post. I've been married for almost 20 years to my second husband, and we have three kids together. My dog is a black lab, and I drive a Honda Odyssey minivan. So my first message for you is that domestic violence happens to everyone. All races, all religions, all income and education levels. It's everywhere. And my second message is that everyone thinks domestic violence happens to women, that it's a women's issue. Not exactly. Over 85% of abusers are men. And domestic abuse happens only in intimate, interdependent, long-term relationships. In other words, in families, the last place we would want or expect to find violence, which is one reason domestic abuse is so confusing. I would have told you myself that I was the last person on earth who would stay with a man who beats me. But in fact, I was a very typical victim because of my age. I was 22. And in the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are three times as likely to be domestic violence victims as women of other ages. And over 500 women and girls this age are killed every year by abusive partners, boyfriends and husbands in the United States. I was also a very typical victim because I knew nothing about domestic violence, its warning signs or its patterns. I met Connor on a cold, rainy January night. He sat next to me on the New York City subway. And he started chatting me up. He told me two things. One was that he, too, had just graduated from an Ivy League school, and that he worked at a very impressive Wall Street bank. But what made the biggest impression on me that first meeting was that he was smart and funny, and he looked like a farm boy. He had these big cheeks, these big apple cheeks, and this wheat blonde hair, and he seemed so sweet. One of the smartest things Connor did from the very beginning was to create the illusion that I was the dominant partner in the relationship. He did this, especially at the beginning, by idolizing me. We started dating, and he loved everything about me. That I was smart, that I'd gone to Harvard, that I was passionate about helping teenage girls and my job. He wanted to know everything about my family and my childhood, my hopes and dreams. Connor believed in me as a writer and a woman in a way that no one else ever had. And he also created a magical atmosphere of trust between us by confessing his secret, which was that as a very young boy, starting at age 4, he had been savagely and repeatedly physically abused by his stepfather. And the abuse had gotten so bad that he had had to drop out of school in 8th grade, even though he was very smart. And he'd spent almost 20 years rebuilding his life, which is why that Ivy League degree and the Wall Street job and his bright, shiny future meant so much to him. If you had told me that this smart, funny, sensitive man who adored me would one day dictate whether or not I wore makeup, how short my skirts were, where I lived, what jobs I took, who my friends were, and where I spent Christmas, I would have laughed at you. Because there was not a hint of violence or control or anger in Connor at the beginning. I didn't know that the first stage in any domestic violence relationship is to seduce and charm the victim. I also didn't know that the second step is to isolate the victim. Now, Connor did not come home one day and announce, you know, hey, all this Romeo and Juliet stuff has been great, but I need to move into the next phase where I isolate you and I abuse you. So I need to get you out of this apartment where the neighbors can hear you scream and out of this city where you have friends and family and coworkers who can see the bruises. Instead, Connor came home one Friday evening and he told me that he had quit his job that day, his dream job. And he said that he had quit his job because of me, because I had made him feel so safe and loved that he didn't need to prove himself on Wall Street anymore. And he just wanted to get out of the city and away from his abusive, dysfunctional family and move to a tiny town in New England where he could start his life over with me by his side. Now, the last thing I wanted to do was leave New York and my dream job. But I thought you made sacrifices for your soulmate. So I agreed, and I quit my job, and Connor and I left Manhattan together. I had no idea I was falling into crazy love, that I was walking headfirst into a carefully laid physical, financial, and psychological trap. The next step in the domestic violence pattern is to introduce the threat of violence.
So I am gonna stop
and see how she reacts.
We're not even quite halfway through that, but the link to that video is in your presentation, so you can go and watch it. It's just on YouTube. She actually wrote the book Crazy Love, and this was filmed as a result of the high profile that book became. And she actually does marry him and sort of describes in a bit more graphic detail some of the violence that occurred in that relationship. But I do want to be mindful of our time and sort of press through really quickly on just a couple more things and make sure I give you a couple of handouts. Well, one handout anyway. So I'm going to keep going here. We do this every year. We do a community care for domestic violence census in the state of California. And we have about 100 domestic violence service providers statewide. And once a year, we take sort of a one-day census of their services. That just gives you a little bit of idea of what's happening out there in the community in our state in particular. On that one day, 5,300 victims were served. 2,800 victims found refuge in emergency shelters around the state. 2,500 adults and kids received some kind of non-residential services, so counseling, legal advocacy, some kind of kids support. Almost 1,300 hotline calls were answered. And the important thing to note here is that we still had 612 unmet needs. So somebody who made some kind of contact that the state was not able to serve. And that's just in one day around the state. The primary unmet need for that was some kind of shelter. or housing. So 66% of those were folks that couldn't access some kind of shelter or housing. So I think it relates to the video as well. So when you hear, why doesn't she just leave? The major reason is she has nowhere to go. We have very limited shelter access here in the state, and it's not just a California problem, it's a nationwide problem. But having a safe place to leave, I'm doing the thing where I forget to stand in front of the microphone, is the number one reason. So I do want to just talk a little bit about our response, particular Berkeley Christian Counselors and also some of the other ministries that we have around campus. The church actually does have a policy for what to do if one of our parishioners is being investigated for some kind of a violent crime, whether that be against a child or in a crime of a sexual nature. And I do think it's important just that you know that we have that in place. Sometimes it means somebody can't be involved in certain ministries. Sometimes it means that somebody can attend worship, but they need to be on campus with a partner. So somebody's going to follow them around wherever they go on campus so that we're making sure that other members of our congregation are kept safe. And that's something that we've enacted on 5 or 6 occasions. So just so you know that, you know, here it's not just, oh, they're a perpetrator or they've been found guilty. And not all of these situations relate to domestic violence in particular. Some of them are crimes against children. And without going into the details of that, it's just important to know that that happens and that we do have a response as a church. And we do both extend safety to victims who might be a part of this congregation and also grace to perpetrators who may want to continue to participate in our services and ministries that we have here. Unlike some service providers in the community, we do actually believe in extending grace in those circumstances. So that is a part of the piece of our policy. In addition, we have some incredible ministries here, Berkeley Christian Counselors, which you've heard about, which is doing quite a bit of trauma-informed counseling, both for members of our church and members of the community. And also Stephen Ministry, which is providing care to folks in any kind of situation where they might need someone to walk alongside them and provide that care. And those can be resources that you provide to those that you might be suspecting. One thing that I do really quickly want to call your attention to is this do's and don'ts. If you have an inkling that someone in your life is experiencing something like this kind of abuse that we've been talking about today, don't wait. Initiate some kind of conversation. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it's some big thing. It could just be, I'm concerned. I'm praying for you. Your husband calls the office a lot, and you seem afraid. I'm concerned about that. Sometimes what happens, especially in families, so if this is your sister or niece or whatever, is that families feel like we need to put parameters on that. I'll help you financially, but only if you leave him, or only if XYZ happens. And that puts somebody who's already powerless in an even further power strictured situation. So the best advice really is to not do that. As much as you can, be supportive without placing boundaries on what that looks like or conditions on what that looks like. Doesn't mean that you need to give in to everything, but that in general, that's the best advice in terms of offering care. Some people ask about advocacy, so I think this is important to bring up. One of my colleagues at Johns Hopkins, Jackie Campbell, does a lot of research on guns and domestic violence relationships, and a couple of her studies have found that access to guns yields a more than 5-fold increase of intimate partner homicide. Seems obvious. And then of females killed with a gun, almost 2/3 were killed by their intimate partners. So there is a connection between access to guns and intimate partner violence. And that's more than 3 times higher than the total number murdered by male strangers. Using all weapons of any kind
in single victim, single offender incidents. So it's a huge difference. And that really does, in some ways, make it a women's issue. People come down on gun control in all sorts of ways, but I will just put that out there in terms of the statistics and how they relate to this particular type of violence. We do know that orders of protection can really help. Folks with orders of protection who've been interviewed state that the order has somehow worked to help greatly reduce or completely eliminate the threat of violence. Unfortunately, not all people who even qualify them for them apply for them, and some folks that do apply and qualify don't actually get them. Only about half of the folks who apply and qualify actually get them. For some of the reasons that I mentioned earlier, a judge might be afraid to prevent a father from seeing his children when the threat of violence is involved. So some of that might be advocacy at the legal level and education in that regard. Okay, we are getting folks from who are going to come see this next time. So I realize that we sort of ran out of time, but you feel free to come up and get my card. And I have one more handout on you know, signs that you're in an abusive relationship. So sometimes even if all you can do is hand this to someone to get them to think about it, that may be enough. I'm sorry that we went over, but Bridget, did you have anything else that you wanted to say or add?
No, I just wanted to say thanks so much for coming.
Oh, sure, sure.
And unlike so many of our other classes, I'm so glad Kristen is a very hyper-local resource for us.
Right.
So you all got her cards and her email address if there's more questions. Thank you so much for
Yeah.